Hey guys, welcome back to another week of Autastic, your comedian's guide to autism. I'm one of your hosts, Kirk Smith, and my co-host and buddy,
Graham K. What's up, everybody?
Woo!
Thanks for tuning in again. We got a good one. We got a
interesting
another interview from roving reporter Jill Escher, and she did a fantastic job. Another bang up job, I will have to say, by Jill Escher.
Great job, Jill.
From the conference in Montreal. I forget what the name of the conference is, but she says it a few times in her interview. Do you know what it is? Do you remember what it's called?
Starts with an I. I know that.
We're the worst. We both just listened to the interview. Anyway, who cares? The information's in this episode. Keep listening. We are not scientists. We are two dum-dums, obviously, but we are two stand-up comedians who with loved ones with autism. My brother has autism on a level two, let's say. We're using the new jargon. And your son is more of a level three. How about that?
Yeah, I think that's about right. He's on the severe end of the spectrum. Love him very much. What can I tell you about him? Yeah, you tuned in last week and you can hear all of his escapades. Yeah, but he's doing good. He's doing good. Baby steps. Baby steps.
Baby steps. Sometimes there's a baby step backwards too, but don't get discouraged, buddy. You'll get two forward soon enough.
In all seriousness though, it was the International Society for Autism Research. ISAR. Yeah. So, that's the big conference, and we've got five interviews we're spacing out. And what do you think? Should we play this thing? And then, actually, what's going on in your life? You have a week in review, Graham?
We'll do a quick week in review with my brother. My mother sometimes emails me when she can't get info out of my brother. And she, Peter will tell me instead of telling his mom.
You're the spy. You're the spy.
Yeah, and normally for something like this, I wouldn't sort of read it if it'd be too private, and it, you know, reading it on air and it's Peter's personal business, and there is certainly a fine line here, but this one I think is just funny, so I'm going to read it. My mother wrote me. She goes, "I had occasion to speak with Peter today because a condo envelope was being sent to his door. And he needs to deliver it to me." So he lives, my mother deals with all his apartment stuff. And so he's got to do an errand. In speaking to him, he said he emailed 20 of his relatives. I said, "Oh my, what about?" He replied that some things have to stay secret.
Well, there you go.
And then she goes, "God knows. We can't force him, but I'm very curious. Graham, can you chat him up?" Could he be sending to 20 people?
You are the spy.
And I know what it is. It's his birthday. It's just about his birthday. And he just is emailing, you know, but he thinks that birthday and Christmas are secret things. For no reason. Like, he's been told that presents are secret.
Right.
So it's probably about a present he's going to send me, because my birthday is right by his, so we both get presents, and doesn't want mom to know, or it's about presents. The more likely reason is he told everybody what he wants, and he doesn't want my mom to know because he thinks that birthdays are a secret, even though he probably told her what he wants. I don't
Makes
know.
Sense.
So he's just... Does it? But it's this kind of thing that goes on when you have a loved one with autism. So that's what's going on in Pete's life. You know,
I wanna talk about this.
He's ramping up for birthdays.
He's ready. He's ready to.
Yeah, he's ready.
He's got that list. He's checking it, and making it twice. See who can give him what.
He's got that list. He's checking it once, twice. 5 million times all day, every day.
Sounds about right. Mm-hmm. Good for him. Hope he gets what he wants. We have an interesting interview, and I had some I wanted to talk about a little bit. Should we play the interview?
Let's play the interview.
Let's do it.
Hey, everyone. Roving reporter Jill Escher here. sitting here at the Montreal Airport at the close of INSAR, the International Society for Autism Research Conference. About to head back home to the San Francisco Bay Area, and seated right next to me is Dr. Jennifer Phillips. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Actually, you have to join us because we're both in the same airport terminal together. You have no choice.
We're on the same plane.
We're on the same plane. Dr. Phillips is an associate professor and clinical psychologist at Stanford University, my alma mater, and she has diagnosed more than 2,000 children in her career, and we're here to talk to her about being a diagnostician, doing diagnostics, and maybe winding up talking about some of the research that you're doing.
Sounds good.
Because you do both. You're a clinician, and you also participate in lots and lots of research. So, and some, including my children from years ago. So, Dr. Phillips, we were talking on the way here, and you have diagnosed more than 2,000 cases. And these are mostly autism. Tell me, who comes into your clinic and why?
So we would have anybody come into the clinic, pretty much all ages. The youngest might be 15 months, all the way up to young adult. And it's primarily for first-time diagnosis. Every once in a while, we also see follow-up clinics. Mm-hmm. So we'll have families who we follow over the years come through as well.
So it's parents who have concerns about their child's mental or intellectual or behavioral development.
Right. And it might be a combination. A lot of the children that we've been seeing lately are in the elementary, middle school, high school age range. Mm-hmm. And many times it's first time concern about possible autism, and mm-hmm. maybe they've been dealing with issues that have been diagnosed or misdiagnosed as ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder, mm-hmm. or, you know, something like that in the past, and they've been routed to us because there are also social difficulties, and someone has brought up the question of a possible autism diagnosis,
right,
too.
So when people come to your clinic at Stanford, they have a suspicion about something.
Right.
They come to you. They want to get a written diagnostic after a thorough evaluation.
Yes, exactly.
And so let's just take your average family. So they walk in with a 2 or 3 year old, probably. And I have to ask you, do you know the moment you lay eyes on that kid what the diagnosis is going to be, at least some of the time? Or what really happens in your mind?
So sometimes you go out to the waiting room and meet the child and know that something's going on pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say more and more over the years, that's been mixed in with a lot of children who in the waiting room, I don't really know. And I do really need that full assessment to get a better handle on what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mix. But there are definitely children who right away when you go out, you know, they don't look at you, they don't show any interest in you, they're maybe doing something repetitive, and it's pretty likely at that mm-hmm. point in my mind that something's going on.
Right, and I'm kind of at the point now where sometimes I meet a kid and I'm like, I could diagnose it in the flash diagnostic.
Yeah.
And then there are this more subtle cases, right, where their intellectual functioning might be okay, but then when you get mm-hmm. into complex social interactions, they don't come up to standard levels.
Yeah.
So you, as a diagnostician, you have a battery of diagnostic tests that you mm-hmm. use. And I guess you use different tests for different kids, depending on the age and depending what you suspect. Can you tell us a little bit about how you decide what you do next once you, you know, meet the kid?
Yeah. So I would say we start with a very basic kind of across the board battery of things that we want to know about. So we want to have some information about developmental functioning all the time. We might have some previous information about that. That the parents might bring in from the school or from mm-hmm. another outside provider. But we often will repeat that because we also want to spend time getting to know this child, and we have limited ways that we can do that
mm-hmm.
when we're in a clinic setting. And so we'll start with something developmental. We want to know about adaptive daily living skills. So we always have some measure of that as well.
So like the Vineland is a common test.
The Vineland or the ABAS. There's mm-hmm. a few that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nice because kids don't do what they do at home when they come into the clinic all of the time. And so we get that history from a family, mm-hmm. but we also really want to get some data, some quantitative data on what a child's day-to-day life functioning is, mm-hmm. and then compare that to what they might do with us when we're trying to get them to do something formal.
Got it. So they walk in, you have some background information, there's this additional information, then you observe them. Mm-hmm. as well.
Right. So we do some form of a play observation. And the way that I do it in our clinic currently is that we have them in twice. So we meet them the first day and we have someone just playing with them for about 2 hours while we're collecting history in an adjoining room.
Mm-hmm. So from the parents.
From the parents. Mm-hmm. So we're getting a really thorough developmental background, but we're also just hanging out with that child and playing with mm-hmm. a lot of toys. Then they come in the second day, we do the developmental testing, and we do a more formal play observation, and that's, for us, the ADOS. And that allows us to just also quantify some of the social mm-hmm. skills that they have. Mm-hmm. But we're using those two time points, too, because sometimes kids will come in the first day, and they're kind of shy, mm-hmm. they're not warmed up, they don't know us, they don't know the environment. And bringing them in the second day, we can often get them much more comfortable. We want them to have fun and be their normal selves. We don't want them to be upset or, trying to leave the room. It's not going to be very good ways for us to gauge real social skill.
So the written evaluation, you have the warmed up ADOS, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like, come into the room. I'm going to submit,
right
to
away.
The ADOS right exactly. now. So you have the warmed up ADOS. And that's a 2-day process.
It's a 2-day process.
Understand it. No wonder there's such a wait list for diagnostics. Right. So then what? What happens after that?
So we and the assessment takes about a morning. It's like a half a day, mm-hmm. 3 to 4 hours. We have the family back later that week, just the parents. And then we go through all of the results and our impressions. Mm-hmm. And then the written report comes
after that. And
there's
Kleenex on the table.
Yes.
There's Kleenex on the table. Yeah. So how often, I know it's like this is just guesstimating on your part, but of all these kids who come in with suspected autism, what percent do you actually give a diagnosis to, or do you think the diagnosis is warranted?
It's interesting. I think that's changed a bit over the years, and it's changed, I think, in part depending upon just the population of kids and the age group of kids that we've got coming in. Mm-hmm. It used to be when we were really focusing on mostly very little kids, I would say it was pretty likely, mm-hmm. more likely than not, that we were going to make a diagnosis, probably in the 80 to 90% range.
But
because they'd already been screened, they'd gotten to mm-hmm. us as a second or third level.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we're getting referrals from other clinics in our psychiatry department, and those children might have other diagnoses, and they also have some social difficulties, and they may or may not have autism, mm-hmm. but I think that we're also very aware of the impact of social difficulty on the functioning of a child, that the referrals have really gone up, and we might be looking at other diagnoses. So, we may not diagnose autism, and it's sometimes, it's probably more like 60-70% of the time now with the way our clinic is going that we might diagnose autism.
So what are some of the other diagnoses that you see? So autism is mm-hmm. the most frequent.
Right.
But what comes after that?
Right. Probably ADHD. Mm-hmm. After that would be anxiety. Mm-hmm. A lot of the kids who have autism also might have ADHD or anxiety, I should say. But sometimes you'll see a lot of social deficit in a person who has just ADHD.
Sure.
And they don't have the core symptom pattern of autism, but they do have some social difficulties. And you'll see that in anxiety as well, OCD. We see all kinds of kids, but I would say those are the big ones. Sometimes depression. Mm-hmm. Bipolar disorder, but these are getting to be smaller and smaller percentages.
You
of see who
OCD,
we would see.
ODD, oppositional defiant disorder.
Yeah, although I don't tend to diagnose oppositional defiant disorder very much. I just feel like there's usually a cause for disruptive behavior besides just being sort of a core oppositionality.
Okay.
So a lot of kids with ADHD will have disruptive behavior. Mm-hmm. Kids with autism will have disruptive behavior. But I don't tend to give oppositional defiant disorder a lot personally. Hmm. It's rare that I would see a child who I think is just disruptive, and I don't see that there's anything else going on. Yeah.
What about the psychosis? You know, the mm-hmm. You know, other forms of mental illness involving, you know, delusions. Yeah. Do you see that?
Yeah. We occasionally see kids who will come in with a concern for psychosis. It's pretty rare to see very little kids with true psychosis, mm-hmm. But it can sometimes happen. As children get older, the risk for that could potentially go up. Yeah. The likelihood as you reach adolescence might be higher.
Yes. Yes.
Every once in a while, we'll see children who we think have autism, and they also have some signs of psychosis. But many times what will come in as possible psychosis won't really be psychosis. It'll be, you know, fantasy, imagination sort of enactments that are happening.
So it's not voices in the head, so to speak. Right. It's not delusions.
Right. And some children are, you know, literal, and they'll tell you that they hear voices, and it really is just that they hear, you know, their thoughts in their head. Mm. And so we do have a way of kind of conducting some questions to really get at a better understanding of that. It can be hard with some children to pull that apart.
Which is why you need follow-ups, right? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it, you know, it can look like two different things.
Absolutely.
And you're not sure which way it's going to go.
Yeah.
So let's talk about delivering the diagnosis, which is everyone's favorite topic, because in our lives, some of the worst moments in our lives are those moments when we hear our children have autism.
Right.
And I'll never forget when my daughter, who's, you know, my second child with autism, when her diagnostician sat me down and said how much it hurt. She said, "It hurts me to tell you this." And then I knew what was coming, mm-hmm. and I just couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. But I remember that moment, and also when my son was diagnosed. I'm sure it's true with most parents. So from your perspective on the other side of mm-hmm. the table, what are you thinking, and how do you have a certain personal strategy in dealing with that?
Yeah, my strategy is I hate the idea of making a parent who has come in knowing that this is the question that's being asked. They're asking the question. They're asking it of me. I hate the idea of making them wait any longer than they have to hear that.
Okay.
So my strategy is we have our feedbacks really quickly, and we start with what our diagnostic impressions are. Mm-hmm. And then we just process that right at the beginning. And then we go through whatever else we need to do. I make it a really organic process. I have things I'd like to talk about, but all I really want to end with is making sure that I've, you know, been there for that family, but been honest and made sure to tell them about the recommendations that I'm going to make.
Mm-hmm.
Going through all the data is less important for some families.
Well, at that point, they're often in shock. I mean, do you find
that's
that?
Right. Yeah, of course.
I was in shock both times.
Yeah. So we also, we recommend a second appointment. We offer it. Not every family takes us up on it.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to make sure that we're not mm-hmm. just sort of slapping a diagnosis on a kid and sending them off on their way, never to be seen by us again.
Mm-hmm.
So I want families to know that we're a part of that team
mm-hmm.
and we're there for them for any ongoing questions. I mm-hmm. usually will tell families to come back or to call me once they've gotten the report and read it. Because that's a good time to start processing all of the, you know, we're giving them dozens of recommendations and
it'd be several pages of dense information.
Yeah, definitely.
And I do know that Stanford, like a lot of these autism centers, offer a lot of parent outreach, community mm-hmm. outreach, you know, programs, support groups. Often they offer early intervention assistance and, you know, that probably helps as well. You're able to say, hey, you know, we're not just like hanging you out to dry here.
Right.
You know, even though autism is a lifelong thing, we're still not hanging you out to dry here.
Right. We'd like to say that we were able to provide everything for every family, which isn't the way that it works, unfortunately.
It's not.
But we do have a lot of programs. So it is really nice to be able to then say, hey, mm-hmm. let me tell you about the things that we can provide.
Right.
And also the things that the other people in the community that we know and work with provide.
Right.
And we do have a resource coordinator mm-hmm. and a program that is designed free of charge for families to really continue to be there for them, you know, even when they don't need to talk to the clinician, just as a way to have a person to touch base with about anything that they're dealing with as they start navigating all the services that they get told they have to enroll
yeah, that
in.
Was so yeah. much fun. Yeah, and now you get to run the gauntlet.
Right.
of getting services for your child. And then when that one fails, getting another one. And then going through the IEP process. And then they're adults. And then you got to go through it all over again.
Exactly.
Yeah. Have fun, parents. So do you find, you know, you are a psychologist. So people deal with traumatic news in different ways. Mm-hmm. I definitely went through those stages of grief.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. You know, anger, denial. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you end up at kind of this grudging acceptance. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm there yet, frankly, but do you find that with parents? What, do you see a pattern in the parents?
Yeah, I do. You know, but everybody's different. So I feel like some parents will go straight to one stage or another of that grief process, maybe like in the room with us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of families are in shock, especially when kids are little. Mm-hmm. It's interesting when kids come in and they're older and they've had other diagnoses already. In some ways, this is a relief because it explains what they've been struggling with for a really long time that no one was really correctly identifying.
Right. Sure.
And so that's interesting, too. That's a very different process. Mm-hmm. They've probably been through some of those stages in a different kind of a way than other families have by the time they get to us. And then they're just thankful, you know, to get directed to services that no one even told them about maybe before.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm president of Autism Society San Francisco Bay Area, as you know, and I get a lot of those calls from parents in this sort of the mid-childhood. And they're actively seeking, you know, that label for their kid. And I totally understand that. Because their kids are struggling so much, and they want to know it's not because they're bad kids. It's because, you know, the brain wiring is different in there, and maybe there's some support that can help. So do you have any advice for parents who are seeking either a diagnostic or a reevaluation, you know, any advice for what they should do, where they should go? Not just in the Bay Area, obviously. We have a national or actually a global audience, so... What, any advice for them?
Yeah, I would definitely start with a pediatrician or whoever your, you know, provider is and finding out what are the resources in your area. And they may or may not know the pediatrician. And so you may have to then go through other avenues to find out with your insurance company or whatever it might be, who are the mental health providers to get onto those wait lists to be seen. And then I would say once you hook in with a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a developmental pediatrician or whoever it might be, there's multiple people who do these sorts of assessments. To stick with that person and have follow-ups. I don't like to never see someone again. I want to have them come back at critical transitions in the child's life.
Yeah, and as we see it in our community, at least, there really aren't a lot of follow-ups after childhood.
Right, and there should be.
And there should be. And not only for, let's say, a clinical psychological evaluation, but often these people, never were tested for possible genetic causes.
Correct.
Or, you know, metabolic causes or
absolutely.
Other things. You know, GI issues, you name it. I feel like there should be like two stages of autism where you go back in and you get reevaluated for all that stuff.
And things change over time as well. And, you know, the clinician won't tell you about what to expect in adulthood when they've got a two-year-old that they're giving first-time diagnosis to. You need to go back and learn at each stage what are the current interventions and what are the things that we look for at different age levels too. So so I would say having one, you know, having a person who you can go back to that's the same is a really nice, you know, if you can manage to do that and keep that person and go back. I don't see people back just for testing. I'll have them back just for a follow-up appointment. They don't have to, I don't have to retest kids often. Sometimes it's just nice to see them again and say, all right, what's going on now? Let me tell you about what I know about this time period. Let's, you know, how are things going at school? You know, what sorts of services do we need
recommendations
to think about?
For and often the parents need that piece of paper to go advocate
that's
for their kid with the schools or whatever agency they might be working with.
Yeah.
So finally, you're doing some research. Tell us just quickly, because we're almost out of time, but what research you're engaged in.
So we're running assessment for all of our research projects. We have all kinds of treatment trials for little kids, for older kids. We have young adult trials. We have genetics and
And when
neurology.
You say trials, these are interventions. These are
They're
medical
treatments,
treatments or behavioral treatments. Mm-hmm,
exactly. Right. And we kind of have, we have a little bit of all of those things. What I'm personally doing is part of what we're discovering is that we don't have good ways to really tell if we're making the gains that we want to make in some of these treatments. So when we're measuring change over time, it's really important that we have a good measure of that.
Yeah.
And it's a big issue that people are talking about in this entire field. So we've we've been developing a measure of social motivation, which has sort of expanded into a general social dimension scale, to be better at seeing if we're actually
making a difference,
increasing social
ability.
Well,
it's hard because with autism, you don't see these major leaps. I mean, let's just admit it. I mean, as much as we'd like to say we do, the changes with treatment tend to be more on the subtle side.
They're more subtle.
Yeah.
And especially because we're often measuring with short time periods. So if we're looking at the difference in 24 weeks, we're not going to see changes on an IQ test or on a measure of adaptive behavior because it's just not fine-tuned enough to see that.
Right, right. So, well, good luck with that. And I hope you find things that actually help families. It's been hard to come by in the autism world. It's progress, let's admit it, progress has been slow and grudging. So we wish you luck and all of your colleagues. So thank you, Dr. Phillips. It's nice to sit in the airport with you. And I apologize for all the background noise, everybody.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, what'd you think, Graham?
Like I said off the top, I really enjoyed Jill's interviewing style of late. And she asked a lot of questions. That you as a parent must have had as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I thought it was good to talk about basically, which is one of the toughest conversations you're going to have as a parent.
I can't imagine, guys. Listeners out there.
Yeah, that you might have.
My heart goes out to you. And you too, Kirk. I can't imagine.
And you might have it, you know, burned into your memory forever. And so I think it's interesting to hear her perspective. I did think it was encouraging to hear, like, a good reminder of, you know, she's diagnosed 2,000 kids. And so I think is what she said off the top. And so, yeah, it's nice to feel like, okay, well, this isn't something that she's going to, what in the world's happening here? Just like so out of left field, you know, where it's like, no, we see these kids every week.
She's an expert.
And, yeah, for lack of a better word, yeah, an expert. And not that the parents aren't, but she's got more experience seeing different levels and varying different stories. And I did think it was insightful, too, with her talking about check back in, because the stuff you're going to want to know for a toddler isn't the same stuff that your mom's going to be curious about for Pete, obviously. It's
absolutely
different.
And with therapy, you can, the level of your child's autism can go down.
Yeah, the level of I would say it's slightly different, but yeah, they could become higher functioning. They could they could learn tools to help them in their day-to-day lives. I think it'll still be a lifetime, you know, struggle, but yeah, they'll get some tools to figure out how to navigate.
What did you think? Was there anything resonated with you specifically other than the diagnosis?
I think it's interesting that they talked a little bit about the relief of the diagnosis too for some people, because
I think that would be for higher functioning children to just be able to more, it's, you know, you're like, okay,
something to point at.
Not a toddler, but like maybe a 10-year-old or 12, and you're like, what is going on? And now you know why little Johnny is not making friends at school. You know?
I think, you know, everybody's so different, but I do think it's very interesting how even today, you know, autism's in the news, there's TV shows, there's the podcast, there's whatever, books, and even today, people are still hesitant to receive that diagnosis, and that wasn't my experience. I mean, the labels don't scare me as much as the lifetime does. It's like, if you want, call it whatever you want. this clearly needs help. Let's get the help. I don't know. But I guess everybody's right. So different, you know.
I hear you. Well, just people realizing that it's not bad gas and it's going to pass. It's a lifelong thing.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's crystallizing some of their fears that they maybe in their heart of hearts had.
They already
and
knew.
It puts it to words, and they already know at some level. But I will say this. I know a lot of, I get a lot of notes from people that are like, my sister's kid is clearly autistic and she won't have him tested because she doesn't want the diagnosis. I will say, if you're listening, you're on the fence, the diagnosis doesn't do anything. The diagnosis doesn't affect whether your kid has autism. Right. So if you're on the fence, have him test, have him or her tested. Well, that's not,
you can get help. You can get help.
Yeah, that's not in any way a jab.
And early years are important. Early years are more important. So
I agree.
Later years. So anyway, good stuff. Great interview. You also get some bonus baby crying in the background and some French announcements happening in the Pierre Trudeau International Airport. It's,
I think the baby crying in the background was like a little foreshadowing of what's to come. You're like,
yeah.
Get ready for your crying baby.
These two women who are both very used to people with autism and the crying baby did not faze them at all. They're like, this is not
dress it at all.
Yeah, they don't even hear it anymore. They're so tough. Okay.
So first of all, that baby's fully clothed, not running around ripping off his pants. Nothing.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. Good job. Amazing job, ladies.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jill, once again. And yeah, so wonderful stuff. Thanks for listening, guys. That's another episode, right? We did it?
We did it, guys. Check us out on social media. Graham, what are your social media handles?
Instagram K on Instagram, Mr. Graham K on Twitter, Graham K on Facebook. Also find us on Patreon.com. Donate as little or as much as you'd like to donate. Helps keep us doing it. We need your money desperately. No, I'm kidding. patreon.com/autastic. And Kirk?
Kirk Smith Comedy on all your social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I appreciate your follows and spread the word about podcasts. Most of this is word of mouth. We really appreciate you sharing it. You can now find us on Spotify too, if that's helpful to you, if you listen to Spotify. We are on there, and I will be in Halifax this weekend. So I'll probably have left Halifax by the time this comes out. But then after that, I'll be in London, Ontario, Canada. And come say hi in Toronto all week.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
That's it. Have a great week. You can do it.